Radio Gorgeous, where women do the talking.
I am sitting here in Blackheath, gorgeous Blackheath, on a gorgeous day with Zoe Pilger. And obviously we're at the pub. Obviously. Anyway, we're drinking coffee. Anyway, let's anyone think we're that naughty on a Monday morning. Zoe Pilger, you are the art critic for The Independent, and you have just brought out your first novel, yeah. Eat My Heart Out. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Well, thank you for having me.
I wanted to start and talk about you first, because you are in your late 20s. If I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I'm
29.
30 in September. The last few months.
She says with a wrinkle of her nose, bye-bye, 20s. it gets better.
Yeah, everyone says that.
Yeah, it does. All that doubt and insecurity, although you can't have that much. You're an art critic for The Independent. You're working on your PhD. You brought out your first novel. It's being published in the U.S. in May. Like, yeah, please tell me you are confident.
Yeah, I feel, I think I'm a confident person, but I think the sort of doubt and self-doubt is really part of writing, and if I lost that, I might not have anything, I might not sort of have that sort of engine to write anymore, so. Mm-hmm.
That's that first editor.
Confident. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But so tell me, because that's a big job. And not that I'm in any way implying that you are unqualified for it, but it's a big job for anybody at any age. And you've had it for a while. How did that come about?
Being an art critic for The mm-hmm. Independent. Well, I started writing art reviews for The Independent about 2.5 years ago now. And it came about, well, actually, through my 20s, I entered a lot of writing competitions for everything from poetry to, you know, short stories. And I entered the Fries Writers Prize in 2011, which was for art reviewing, and I saw the notice for the prize about a day before the deadline, and I went to review Tracy Emin's retrospective at the Hayward
yes,
Gallery.
Love, I saw that.
Love is What You Want.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing.
Yeah, did you enjoy it?
I did.
And so, I mean, a lot of the themes in that exhibition overlapped with my PhD on romantic love and kind of sexuality. So I was familiar with that sort of territory. And I just wrote the 700-word review and entered it. And I won it. So it sounds incredible. I mean, I hadn't won any other competitions at all.
The ones you worked harder on, spent all this time
yeah,
on.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it had never occurred to me before then, really, to write art reviews, although my PhD is about contemporary art, or the French artist Sophie Carl. So then I just sent that off to lots of different editors, and The Independent had a vacancy. So that's how I
Fantastic.
Started doing it. And
I
now
love
I
it.
Write 1,300-word feature-length review every week. So last week I reviewed Barbara Kruger at Modern Art Oxford.
Great.
Who's obviously a really interesting feminist artist. And this was more her kind of new work. But I remember when I was doing A-level art at school and coming across for the first time, you know, her really iconic works from the
yes.
80s, like Your Gaze Hits the Side of My Face, a slogan, text and image work with a black and white photograph of a female classical statue, and obviously the implication being that the male gaze in feminist terms is sort of akin to being punched in the face.
It's an assault.
An assault, yeah. And also I shop, therefore I am, which
yes,
has
yeah.
been since hideously commodified. No?
Yeah, by Selfridges. It's like, yeah. wow, yeah. Yeah, because I remember coming across her in the 80s in New York, her work. So that's what you did last week. What's coming up next?
What am I doing? I'm going to review the Liverpool Biennale on Wednesday.
Wonderful.
And then next week I'm doing Malevich at Tate. It's a big exhibition.
Wonderful. You get all around town.
Yeah, I do. I travel a lot around the UK, which is really great, actually, because I've been to, you know, lots of different places that I didn't know at all before. And some of my favourite art galleries in the UK are regional, like Nottingham Contemporary is a fantastic gallery. I love Turner Contemporary in Margate. It's a great privilege to do that job. It's really...
Where else would you suggest for a day trip for people looking to get out of London, looking to do something different, want to see some art? Where should they go?
I actually really think the Thanet Coast, where Margate is, I just love. I lived, when I was 23, I moved to Broadstairs, which is the next town next door to Margate. And I lived there for 6 months when I was first trying to write.
Wow.
In complete isolation.
So, there's nothing but antique shops in Broadstairs. I've been there.
Yeah, have you? Yeah. No, I love it. And it's very physically beautiful, but it's also... it's very sort of uncanny, you know. There's a lot of eccentric people who live down there, and I just love all seaside and kind of decaying English port towns, because my grandma lives in Portsmouth, so I sort of grew up going there, and I've written quite a bit about sort of short stories about seaside towns, so maybe they'll make their way into a novel at some point.
Yeah. Well, maybe that was part of that Tracy Emin connection with Margate.
Yeah, possibly, yeah. Mm.
Excellent. Okay, so now let's talk about Eat My Heart Out. I'm going to sum it up because I felt strongly, and Erica Jong's fear of flying is mentioned in the book. And I would say it is a fear of flying for your generation.
Really?
I think it has that same searching. It's a young woman searching.
Mm.
You know, just floundering around, flailing around, messily, loudly, raunchily, flailing around, trying to figure this shit out.
Yeah.
You know? You tell me what you think.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you to compare it to Fear of Flying. Yeah, I mean, that's what it is to me as well, and that's what I wanted to do. And also what I wanted to do is to give Anne-Marie, who's the main character, she's 23, and she's just failed her university final exams, and she's working in a minimum wage job in Soho and kind of careering around, sleeping with unsuitable men. But I wanted to give her a proper existential crisis, so her state of crisis isn't just triggered by the fact that she's broken up with her ex-boyfriend. It's not, to me, principally about men, although she may understand it in those terms and frame it a lot in those terms of romance and the loss of love. But actually, I think, without sounding like a horrible pretentious wanker, I think her concern is really existential and philosophical, and that's a common feature of lots of male coming-of-age novels with an anti-hero, but it's less frequently found or flagged up in writing by women with a female protagonist, because, you know, our concerns are so much more often thought to be, you know, confined to men, basically, or all about men. So all the way through the novel, Anne-Marie talks about freedom. She says things like, I don't want to feel free. I want to feel constrained by something that's not evil, something that I can trust. So she's really sort of in search of boundaries, but she's definitely a non-conformist. And she's very forceful and she's very anarchic, and her rebellion is very disorderly and sort of messy. Scattergun.
Yeah. There's even a dirty protest, you know, upon leaving Cambridge. But it's because, as you say, Bret Easton Ellis, it's like sort of, you know, it's your London life where you know the bits that you don't tell your parents, you know, when you're hurtling through your 20s and, you know, the 5 o'clock mornings, you know, the drugs, the drinking, the sex, the insanity. But she is really searching, and for something trustworthy. All of the people in the book, perhaps with the exception of her friend Freddie, but they all lie.
Yeah.
everybody is putting up a front. And she's really exposing it. You know, in the end, she is left with herself. Where do you think, what's the end journey for her?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, they do all lie. And I think a lot of, Anne-Marie's expressing a kind of classic, to me anyway, romantic, capital R, disenchantment with this social world of lies, the social performance that she feels all around her, which is a kind of adolescent, maybe young person's position. But I don't think any the less authentic for that. And Anne-Marie herself mm-hmm. often lies. But she does it very deliberately and strategically, albeit kind of ad hoc. And she's kind of self-aware enough to try and engineer certain situations. But ultimately, I think that she has a kind of very forceful, brutal kind of honesty, which to me carries its own kind of morality. I don't think she really lies to herself, or maybe she does. You know, she thinks she's in love with Vic, but maybe that's just a kind of elaborate self-delusion, and Vic is a sort of cipher, blank page onto which she can project all these romantic fantasies.
As she did with Sebastian.
Yeah, exactly. Before him. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I guess what I really wanted to do was not to create the kind of traditional character arc whereby the protagonist ends up in a position of redemption or asking for redemption. She's not really sorry at any point. And I also really didn't want to, at one point, just give her a backstory about her childhood, which would explain her very dysfunctional behaviour in a kind of classic sort of psychoanalytic way. Oh, the X, Y, and Z happened, so this is why you're acting out in this way. I really wanted to resist that. I guess to make it more uncomfortable for the reader and make it, I wanted the book to really ask a series of questions rather than give any answer, particularly about feminism. Mm-hmm. So, for example, with the character Stephanie Haight, you know, she is sadistic, she's deranged, but she also has a real point, and I think her sense of struggle is an authentic one. And I mean, that came out of me reading a lot of feminist, second wave feminist books for my PhD and trying to sort of understand them and think about how they might apply to today. And, you know, I have enormous admiration for that generation of feminists. So Stephanie Haight's behaviour in no way, I mean, represents my kind of rejection of that generation of feminists at all. But one of the things I love about fiction is that you have that space to just explore. You know, you don't have to take a kind of thou shalt position, mm-hmm. or, you know, like as in the Victorian times, create a work of art in whatever form that's designed to kind of improve public morals, yes. or, you know,
you don't have to be on a mission.
Exactly. And yeah, that's what's great fun about writing fiction. Mm-hmm.
RadioGorgeous.com.
But it's funny that you say about making the reader uncomfortable. And it was the first time I read, because I'm 47, and it was the first time I read something, I was like, this isn't aimed at me. You know, this is not aimed at my generation. But then I just started laughing my head off. Because I realized, oh my God, it's so funny.
Oh, thank you.
So, I mean, and was that part of your aim?
I think
uncomfortable, funny, fine
yeah.
line. Yeah,
it's funny because I've only had to really reflect on writing comedy since the book came out, mm-hmm. and what humour is and what dark comedy is and tragic comedy and all those things. I don't really have a theory for it. It's just when I was trying to write fiction, that's the style which came most naturally mm-hmm. to me, and I seem to be incapable of writing fiction without jokes in it, without some like really perverse, like absurdist kind yes. of dimension. And I really don't know why that is, but I guess
I'm really serious and I'm reading all this feminist literature and yet I'm a goofball on the page. You
know? Yeah, I think, I don't know, like sense of humour is really important to me, and so much of our sense of humour comes out of relationships, of friends, family, you know, and joking, and that's how you sort of see the world and analyse and understand the world and deal with the world. I really love Julia Davis, who wrote and starred in a series 10 years ago on the BBC called Nighty Night, and in which she plays a sort of deranged West Country femme fatale who owns a beauty salon.
Hysterical.
Yeah, and that's very dark. And I remember when I first saw that, I was just completely blown away by it, because there just are so few female comedy role models which actually put their finger on something which is dangerous, because she's really challenging conventional feminine roles and stepping outside of those and behaving in a way which is shocking, even on the screen, scripted as
and
a
shocking
show.
To other women and shocking to men, and just shocking, but hysterical.
Yeah, and there is a real subversiveness in that. You know, humor has this great kind of destabilizing power to it, where you can just reveal the absurdity of supposedly normal gender relationships. I mean, Julia Davis often explores like power and hierarchy in relationships. In another series she did with Rob Brydon called Human Remains, which is just brilliant. And I guess the only other kind of role model that I, or role model, I'm not really sure about that word, but that I found was Muriel Spark, and particularly her novel The Driver's Seat, which again has this like razor sharp humour. Those were the only two. I mean, I really hate most TV comedy. I don't like stand up comedy, and I don't I don't really find
Doesn't
it funny.
Reach you.
But
yeah, humor has this power to, you know, if you say, okay, I'm going to write a feminist book, everyone's like, not looking. But it's like, made you look. You know, if you get in there with humor, made you look, made you think, you know, without it being so threatening.
Well, that's very interesting, because that wasn't at all pre-planned. I didn't think, I'm going to write a feminist book that's funny so people will have to read about feminism. Because again, like, trying to do that would be impossible.
Be fail.
Like, how the hell can I crack a joke about feminist theory? It's just, it's like when someone says, go on, tell us a joke. You know, it's just, it's got to come kind of out of nowhere, in a sense.
Well, and it very much comes off the page as if it came from the gut.
Yeah.
But tell me about the writing process and the editing process with Hannah Westland.
Yeah.
Because I know her as a relentlessly upbeat person.
Yeah.
So if anyone can bully a book out of somebody, it would be the happy pit bull that she is. You know? So tell me about that process, how she found you, and how this book came about.
Well, Hannah is amazing, and I really, like, I wanted to write in the acknowledgements that Eat My Heart Out is a co-production between Hannah and I.
Wow.
Because, although she's very modest, so she wouldn't let me, but it really was, you know, I'm not just saying that. I think in those early years when you're very, well, I first started trying to write fiction when I was 23, after I'd just graduated from university. And I wrote, I went and stayed in my grandma's house in Portsmouth, and in her spare room, I wrote the first 20,000 words of a novel called Cover Me, which was the first really sustained fiction that I'd written. And it was extremely raw, even more so than Eat My Heart Out. It was extremely aggressive, and it was actually really darker, I would say, and more experimental in style. And after I had written it, I was really, really horrified by what I had produced, in a sort of like, in a sort of Rosemary's Baby kind of way.
Wow.
And that's the strange kind of dualism of producing, dualism, I don't know if that's the right word, but producing very dark fiction and trying to live a kind of balanced, happy life is a strange split identity that I guess I've become more and more comfortable with. But when I first started to write, I was really shocked by my what I was writing.
Like, is this who I am really? Like, yeah. If this black tar is coming out of me, like,
yeah, well,
spewing this.
Yeah, and it's the darker side of the psyche, and obviously that has a place in life. You know, it's
going to come out anyway. So
yeah,
it's best if it comes out contained on a page.
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, it's something that I've thought about a lot, because I think that's why you so rarely see things like Nighty Night or The Driver's Seat by Muriel Spark, because there is such an added pressure on women in particular to be sweet and good and nice and be so well versed all the time in social propriety. And obviously, as I said before, fiction is a space to really break out of that. So but anyway, that was a massive tangent. So I sent that first 20,000 words to Hannah, who was then an agent at RCW, and she wrote back and said she'd like to see the full manuscript. And by then I'd moved to Broadstairs in Kent, and I didn't want to write the rest of it. I really hated it, and I was just writing these kind of experimental stuff. I was very influenced by people like Kathy Acker, who wrote Blood and Guts in high school, and Anna Kavan, and so I was writing things really with no plot, no characterization, and no forward progression whatsoever. So obviously that's not really commercially viable in any sense. And but Hannah and I stayed in touch, and she kind of mentored me over the next 2 years and read everything I wrote and was really encouraging and really believed in my writing from the beginning, and met up with me. And then in 2010, I wrote the first draft of Eat My Heart Out. And so, I mean, Hannah's input has just been completely invaluable, and I doubt that the book would have got written without her. You know, it's... I've just been so fortunate.
Well, you've actually had the old-fashioned style of editing.
Yeah.
Where an editor draws your novel out of you.
Mm.
You know, Catch 22. They were like, Catch 18? No. Catch 22. You know, this editor, I forget her name, but she literally pulling these things out of Joseph Heller and all these other writers. Mm. That's what editors used to do, as opposed to commission work, which is what editors end up doing now. So you have been wildly privileged to have that kind of thing.
Mm.
That's an incredible experience, and I hope you, whatever comes next, you have that experience again.
Yeah, no, I agree. And again, it kind of, similarly to the art reviewing, it happened in a sort of roundabout way, you know, because I thought I'd like completely catastrophically messed up my chance, where I wrote the beginning of a novel that the agent wanted to see, and then I just didn't finish it. So it came out.
You're like, nah.
Well, I was just, it's that, it's the sort of long process of trying to develop a voice in fiction, and it's an apprenticeship, really. So yeah, I'm glad that I had that time, and I wrote the first three chapters of my next novel in January, which Hannah likes, and you know, we're gonna go ahead with that, hopefully. And that's about a romance writer who gets locked in a mental asylum for pushing against the bounds of the genre.
How fun.
So that's even darker, I think, and probably less intelligible, and that's really inspired by all the period leading up to Eat My Heart Out coming out, and since, where I became sort of privy for the first time to how genre, all these ideas of genre, women's writing and feminine identity, and how they're all bound up together, and how to a large extent actually our ideas of what a woman should be is manufactured by industries like, you know, so-called women's fiction, i.e. chick lit, whatever you want to call it, women's magazine, who so often still peddle these sort of very 1950s ideas, how to catch and tame a man, and really creating our sense of what our life should be. And obviously women aren't completely, you know, I'm not suggesting they're totally brainwashed by that, but I think they are, They're influential. Yeah, they're formative.
Of course, and especially you know, starting out with Disney movies.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Little girls and little boys, and these roles are set, and it's like, wow.
Yeah.
You know, if we want to change things, well, can we change our views of that as well?
Yeah.
And how, I mean, because I think it must be, I was a bit Anne Marie, myself hurtling messily through New York. But of these ideas of, you know, anytime you had a one night stand and you slept with someone, I would always imagine being married to them. Mm. You know, what it would like to marry them. Mm. You know, and it's just like, what? Yeah. What the fuck was I just thinking? You know, it is really weird. And I don't know how your generation, it doesn't seem like it's any better or any easier.
Mm.
You know, there's been a big backlash and, you know, and porn doesn't help.
Mm.
You know, it's like between porn and Disney, you know, you're supposed to be
princess really
porn,
it,
you know, Madonna whore, however you want to put it. Like,
In fact, between porn and Disney, I think that should be the title of a book.
I'll be writing that soon. Between porn and Disney.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production for RadioGorgeous.com. Get in contact with us. Contact us on info@RadioGorgeous.com. And to sign up for our shows to come once a week into your inbox. Who can think of anything better, darling?